and Norm Shealy. NormSheely.com. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Jonathan Dorn, who works with Lester Brown at the Earth Policy Institute in Washington. How are you, Jonathan?
Doing great, Eva. Thanks for having me on your show.
Can you hear me okay?
It's still a little difficult.
We're having some technical difficulties, so if you get to where you can't hear me, let me know, okay, and I'll do my best to speak a little bit louder. I do tend to be quiet sometimes.
Okay.
So before we get started, I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about what Earth Policy Institute is, who you are, and Lester, because Lester was my contact. So let me know who you are, what you do, and about the Institute.
Okay, so the Institute, Earth Policy Institute, is really an organization of hope. I would say that we're a nonprofit environmental research group, and our primary mission is to develop and share a plan for building a sustainable future. And so in doing that, my role at Earth Policy Institute has been looking at renewable energies and, you know, how we can, you know, tackle the problem of global climate change and how that relates to, you know, other problems in the world that we're facing. And of course, Lester Brown, he's a really famous agricultural economist, and he's the president of the organization. And he's a MacArthur Fellow. And, you know, he's really renowned in, you know, sustainability and developing thought around sustainability. And before we really get into the plan B and discussing, you know, what we do at the organization, I just want to notify the listeners that all of our publications at Earth Policy Institute are available free for download from our website. And our website is www.earthpolicy.org. And so feel free to jump on the website and download, you know, anything that I talk about tonight. And there's literature that's on the website that covers everything that I will be talking about.
Thank you, Jonathan. And how can they contact somebody if they have questions?
If they have questions, they are feel free to contact our main telephone number, which is 202-496-9290. And we have a secretary that can direct them to, you know, whoever the best is to answer their question.
Okay. And I just want to mention to you, Lester's got two books, Plant, that I know about, Plan B2 and then Plan 3.0.
Yes.
Are those books available online?
Those books are available online. Not only are the books available, but the data sets behind the books are also available online. And if you're going to look at those, I would look at the most recent one. So it would be Plan B 3.0. The Plan B is really a series, so it started with Plan B and Plan B 2.0. Now we're at Plan B 3.0, and we'll be releasing Plan B 4.0 this coming September.
I tell you what, every adult and parent should read this book because it's in their children's hands, how we go forward, and they need to get this information to their kids. It's serious. What first question I want to ask you is, the big controversy, and this isn't really addressed in your book, really, I don't think, but, you know, Al Gore did the movie that he did about global warming. Some people believe it, some people don't believe it. Why should we believe that there, and I do believe there's issues, but why should my listening audience believe that there's global warming?
We should absolutely believe it. The top scientists in the world have come together in a consensus to basically say with, you know, out any way that you can deny it, that it's definitely here. And so if we look at the scientific consensus, and this is from the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they've been studying, you know, the climate change now for about 20 years. And so they released these consensus reports every, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, I don't know when they get them done. The last report came out in 2007. And from a scientific standpoint, you have to rate things in kind of a technical term of certainty. And basically what the consensus says method of looking at Earth's climate is through ice cores. And so through these ice cores from Antarctica, we can actually recreate what the climate has been over the last hundreds of thousands of years. And we know right now that the planet is nearly as warm as it's been in any time in the past 420,000 years from the founding.
So I have a question here.
Sure.
That's one of the arguments is that it's a cyclical thing. Is that true, or is this happening because of what we're doing to the Earth?
Well,
or is it both?
The cyclical cycles will exacerbate the warming that is man-made, but we know that it's not just a cycle. In these cycles, there's certain things that we can measure in the environment that prove that it is a cycle. For example, people say, oh, it could be one of the solar cycles. And so we look at, you know, incoming solar radiation. It should be warm in both the troposphere and the stratosphere, which are the bottom two layers of the atmosphere. It should be warming them to the same extent. In fact, we're not seeing that at all. We're seeing this drastic warming in the troposphere, but we're seeing a cooling in the stratosphere. So there's evidence that rules out all of these, you know, cyclical cycles.
Sure.
And so, I mean, the top minds in science today are saying, you know, this is definitely happening. And we have, you know, definitive evidence looking at carbon emissions. And so if you look at what, you know, carbon emissions actually are, we're mining all of these fossil fuels. Well, what are fossil fuels? The fossil-based energy is actually, you know, coming from oil and coal, which is essentially just dead plants and animals that was buried millions of years ago. If you look at the science behind photosynthesis and how plants take up carbon, there's different isotopes of carbon, and they preferentially take up one isotope versus another. So we can actually look at the isotopic composition of carbon in the atmosphere, and we know that the carbon buildup in the atmosphere is because of the burning of fossil fuels. It's not because of volcanic emissions or from some other natural source. And if we go back and look at how much carbon dioxide has actually increased in the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution, it's increased from about 280 parts per million to about 385 parts per million today. And so that's a problem because we know that carbon dioxide is one of the most important greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. And so if you look at the sun emits radiation at long wavelengths. And these wavelengths can actually come through the atmosphere. I'm sorry, they're short wavelengths. They come through the atmosphere, they're absorbed by the Earth, and they're emitted as long-wave radiation because the Earth is a black body emitter. That long-wave radiation actually can be trapped by CO2, and so the bonds between carbon and oxygen and CO2 actually will absorb this outgoing long-wave infrared radiation, and it prevents it from being emitted back out to space. It basically captures it and re-radiates it, and part of that energy comes back down to the Earth, and so it's having a difficult time, for the Earth to be releasing its heat back out to space. So this carbon dioxide is trapping it, and that's why it's called a greenhouse effect. It's very similar to walking into a greenhouse with glass that's able to trap heat
mm-hmm.
in it. And so as the atmosphere begins to warm, then we're seeing a lot of trends occurring now. One of the most concerning trends is that of ice melting. And so if we start looking at what's happening at the polar region, for example, the North Pole, we're seeing just drastic losses of sea ice. The last couple of years, we've seen sea ice level lower than recorded history. And we're seeing that there's large areas of around the North Pole now that are completely ice-free in the summertime. And this is actually, you know, thought that it's going to open up like shipping lanes through the North Pole area. And it's a concern because this may be one of the first positive feedbacks that we're seeing in the environment. And so a positive feedback is something that, when it begins to happen, makes whatever is occurring worse. And so, for example, if we look at the light coming in to the Earth, if you have snow, you have what's called an albedo effect. And so this albedo basically is kind of like a mirror, and it's reflecting a lot of this incoming radiation back out to space because it's white, highly reflective. As the sea ice begins to melt, it is exposing large areas. of dark seawater. This seawater is absorbing 80 or 90% of the incoming radiation from the sun, and it's warming the ocean water. And so this is causing accelerated ice melting. And so once these different trends begin to occur in the environment, it's thought that there's going to be environmental tipping points, and in which case, if we hit enough of these environmental tipping points, it's going to be out of humanity's control and arresting climate change. And then we can see, you know, very quick and very catastrophic events occurring. And so if we're looking at what the IPCC group is saying, and unfortunately, I mean, they had these worst-case scenarios in their 2007 report. The data today, if we're, you know, looking at...
who is the report from? Sorry.
Oh, the report is from IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that I mentioned earlier, which
okay.
is the consensus group of 2,500 scientists around the world.
Okay. Tell us, just before you go on, because I think I'd like for people who don't believe it to be able to go there. How do they find that?
So IPCC, you can go, if you Google it, it'll be the first thing that comes up. I can't remember whether they're considered a government organization or whether they're an actual organization, but it would be IPCC.
Okay, I as in Indian, P as in Paul,
yes.
C as in Council, and is that IPCC, that's it?
IPCC.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you because you're fascinating, but I did want to know what that would about.
Oh, no problem. Yes, and like I said, if anybody has questions, feel free to, you know, give us a call at Earthfall Institute. We love, you know, talking about this stuff and, you know, trying to convince the non-believers that it's actually occurring, because we feel that it's important now for as many people to, you know, realize that it's actually occurring. Because one of the interesting things about climate change, and it's hard to grasp, is that it's something that, you know, we're beginning to see today, but when we release this carbon into the atmosphere, there's a lag time, and so we're not going to see the real effects of this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for another 20 or 30 years, like the carbon that we're emitting today. So the environmental impacts that we are beginning to witness today are the result of carbon emissions that have been released 20 years ago. So even if we were to stop emitting all carbon dioxide today, we're still going to see warming in the atmosphere for another 20 or 30 years, and this is very hard for, you know, humanity to grasp. The way that our economic systems have always worked and the way that we've always approached problems is to be very reactive, and so when a crisis occurs, we react and fix it. When the crisis and the, you know, global systems occur from climate change, it's going to be too late to react, and so it's very important to, you know, understand the science, you know, to be proactive and starting to address a lot of the carbon emissions that are being put into the atmosphere today.
Now, how much? I know it's if this all of this happens, the water levels will increase a lot in the oceans. How much time can go by before something like that happens, and then how much will it happen?
So again, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in the 2007 report, said that sea level, if we continue business as usual, which means, you know, if we continue, you know, belching out all of this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that by 2100, their estimated range of sea level rise would be 18 to around 50 centimeters.
And what would that mean to us? Just take the United States, since that's where we are. What would that mean to us?
And so what that means to us is that we would see some flooding in some of the coastal areas. If we look back to what has happened with Hurricane Katrina, even though you can't really say that one hurricane is or isn't, you know, associated with climate change, what we do know is that climate change is causing hurricanes and storms to be much stronger, much more intense. And so as we see the sea level begin to rise, these floodwaters resulting from these intense storms are going to be more devastating. We're going to see the storms, you know, more and more common Category 4, Category 5 hurricanes hitting, you know, the Gulf Coast. And we often think that, you know, with climate change and with problems, we're very kind of self-focused on how this is going to impact the United States. But one thing critical to remember is that we're now a global civilization. And anything that happens to other states around the world directly impacts the United States. And so, for example, the 18 to 50 centimeter sea level rise is now thought to be very conservative. We're seeing that all the projections from the 2007 consensus report, they had worst case scenarios projected. We've already exceeded or on path to exceed all of their worst case scenarios. And so in a meeting last week or 2 weeks ago in Copenhagen, a group of scientists now is saying that we could potentially see sea levels rise up to a meter by the year 2100. That would be absolutely catastrophic. What we're talking about is the inundation of the low-lying areas of Bangladesh, some of the low-lying areas of China. These are areas that are critical for these countries to produce their food, and also where large numbers of people live. And so if we see a meter sea level rise, we're going to see the displacement of potentially 500, 600, 700 million people around the world. That's going to be a flood of environmental refugees, and that would overwhelm the capacity of even, the most sound nations in the world to address. I mean, right now, the population in the United States is, only a little over 300 million. So we're talking about having to find a spot in the world for a population that's twice the size of the United States.
And the size of Atlanta, say.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just kind of crazy to start thinking about how all of these factors are actually linked. And so if we go back to looking at, what's the mechanisms of sea level rise? Well, in the past, it's been that the oceans are heating up, and when water heats, it expands, and so we're seeing that expansion of the oceans. The oceans have such a massive volume that it doesn't take that much heating to actually cause them to expand. And so,
how much temperature rise do we have to see this stuff happening?
Oh, well, the temperature increase so far has only been about 0.6 to 0.7 degrees Celsius. So something that is almost imperceptible to us, but we're starting to see all of this stuff. And that's just the global average. If you're looking at different areas are impacted differently just because of some of these positive feedback. For example, if we look at the Arctic region, where we're losing a lot of the sea ice, the Arctic area has actually increased by about 5 to 6 degrees.
Really?
And that's really substantial. And so if we look at the continued temperature increase and where are we going to see or what is the mechanism that's going to cause sea level rise, one of the main mechanisms could be the melting of the glaciers. And we're already seeing the glaciers in the West Antarctic, the glaciers in Greenland, the glaciers in the Tangutri areas of the high plains of China and Tibet. And that is of real concern because these are the glaciers whose meltwater basically feeds the agricultural fields of China and Asia. And if these rivers dry up because they no longer have the meltwaters from these glaciers during the dry period, then there's not going to be any water to basically feed the agriculture of like these parts of the world. And it's going to create a massive food shortage like we've never seen. And, you're thinking that, maybe this is like way down the road, and actually it's not. It's thought that these glaciers could disappear in the next 40 years. And we're already seeing some effects of climate change out in California. California now is experiencing a 3-year drought. There's been very little snowfall in the Sierra Nevada. And the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada, when it melts, is the primary source of water for the valleys of California, where all the agricultural production is. And we're seeing now that there's been over 1 million acres pulled from farming because there's no water there. And there's been about 60,000 farmers who basically are out of business this year because there's just no water to grow their crops.
So, if just help me understand, if the water is here at one point and it evaporates, why doesn't it come back down?
Oh, it is coming back down, but it's coming down in the form of rain and not snow. And it's also coming down in other areas. And so,
okay.
as climate change begins to happen, what it's actually doing is areas that have been historically wet, some of these areas are beginning to dry out. Other areas that may have been historically dry may be, you know, being flooded. And our society has developed a very stable climate system. We haven't, you know, experienced as a civilization any massive shifts in climate. And so, you know, we've developed areas that historically have the rainfall, have the water, but with climate change, what we could see is that all these patterns that we're historically used to are now going to be shifting. And so that means that, you know, you may have parts of the middle of the United States that require rainfall for some of the wheat production. I'm no longer able to produce wheat because they could, you know, potentially be getting drier. And so one thing that is of big concern with these shifting weather events is that the Amazon could potentially be another one of these so-called positive feedbacks. The Amazon right now gets, you know, lots of rain, and with the evapotranspiration, which is what occurs when a plant absorbs water and then re-releases it through its leaves, is that basically the Amazon is so massive that it creates its own climate system. And so it, you know, the forest needs to be there in order for this rain cycle to continue. We're seeing deforestation now at really alarming rates. And so about 20% of the Amazon has already been cut down. And deforestation is responsible for about 20% of the carbon emissions globally. And so, you know, as the Amazon begins to dry out, because what we're already seeing from climate change is that it is beginning to dry out a little bit, as it begins to dry out, we have this positive feedback where as it begins to dry, there's less moisture through evapotranspiration that's getting back up to the atmosphere that feeds the rain cloud. And so it's thought that one of the consequences of continued climate change is basically that the Amazon will dry out to a point where it will actually catch on fire and completely burn. And if that happens, then it's going to be really, really massive amount of carbon that is re-released back into the atmosphere.
So we have about 20 minutes.
Okay.
I'd like for you to, I could listen to this all night long, but I know there's some more important things to listen to as well. Population control,
okay.
Consumerism, you know, eating animal products. I'd like to talk about those things and how they, you know, what to do about it. How eating so many animal products, how it affects our grains and our water supply and our soil. Talk about those things. And you're free to venture off. I'd just like for you to educate us a little bit about those things.
Okay, sure. And so one of the things that we're concerned with as the world, you know, becomes wealthier is that people want to begin to eat up the food chain. And what that means is that the consumption of meat in the world begins to increase. And so we're seeing this in places like China and India that are experiencing relatively new affluence. You know, they're looking, you know, to the West, and they're saying, oh, well, look what the United States. And, you know, they have a very high protein diet, and that's thought to, you know, be one of the things that a lot of people around the world aspire to, is they want to, you know, eat high protein diet.
Now, is it just meat, or is it dairy and cheese and milk and eggs? Is all that in the same category? Fish, milk, meat, chicken?
It is a bit, as far as dairy products, I would consider that a little, you know, lesser of the evil from eating meat, just because,
okay.
You know, you can have your cow and you can feed your cow and the product of your cow as opposed to slaughtering your cow and then not being able to have that milk production anymore.
Okay. And we're not talking about health issues here. We're talking about effects on the environment, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
Talking about effects on the environment. And so if we're looking at, you know, for example, grain production, that's a perfect example. You know, a lot of people in the United States say, I don't really eat that many grains, but in fact, if you open your refrigerator and you look at what's in your refrigerator, everything in the refrigerator is produced from grains. We're talking about eggs, milk, cheese, almost everything in your refrigerator is essentially a grain product. And
because of the animal eating it, right?
Because of the animal, okay. Right. Because you're feeding all the grains to the animal in order to raise the animal. They're going to need to lay the eggs or produce the milk. And so, you know, as we're looking at grain production around the world, we're seeing that a lot of the grains are actually being diverted to, you know, animal production. And so it would be much better for us to, you know, start eating down the food chain, start eating more grains, less meat, because that means that we'll have, you know, more grains available to, you know, spread around to a lot of the hungry people in the world. And a lot of people in the world still just don't, you know, have the money to buy high protein diets, so we have to make sure that the majority of people around the world have, you know, balance diet as well, and so it's important for countries like the United States to, you know, consume less meat to allow, you know, some of the people in the developing world to consume a little bit more.
Is it also a problem that because of population growth that we don't have enough grain per person to go around compared to what it used to be? I don't think people get this picture.
Right, that is one of the stresses that is currently happening. Population growth is just astounding. You know, from all those projections and stuff and everything that we look at, my generation, it's going to be the last generation that ever sees, you know, a doubling of the world population. And I think that's a very good thing. But the bad, you know, side of that is that, you know, environmental degradation is what's going to cease population growth. And it's going to be at that point that we're really going to reevaluate and realize that, okay, well, we need to bring population numbers back down to reach a point of sustainability with our natural ecosystem. And what most people don't realize is that we're adding, you know, between 70 and 80 million people a year to the world population. But, you know,
and what's the maximum that we can have and survive? And when will that number be reached at the current?
That number is highly contentious in the scientific realm. My personal opinion and, you know, what I believe, and this is a term that's called carrying capacity, and that's just, well, how many members of a certain species can you have in order to, you know, maintain a viable population indefinitely with, you know, without degrading the rest of the ecosystem that one species lives in. And, you know, what I believe is that carrying capacity number is around 2 billion. So, in my view, we're already over three times what the carrying capacity of the world should be for humans. And it's, you know, obviously a very emotional and touchy subject to get in, because it's like, well, what do we do with the excess population? And a lot of it comes back to looking at the root causes of why we have such rampant population growth.
Well, if we're already over it on your number, let's use your number, then it means there's no hope.
No.
Because if we're already over it and it takes 20 or 40 years to stop the cycle, then it means we've reached a tipping point.
Well, I don't think that the global systems are destroyed yet. What we've done and what we see is that around 1980 is when the human race began to extract more materials from the Earth than the Earth can actually replenish. Mm-hmm. And so we are basically borrowing from the Earth right now. We're in kind of this weird thing where you can consider it like we're basically stealing the Earth's assets. And at some point we're going to have to pay those back, or else we're going to have a, you know, drastic population collapse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see this with, if we look at, like, you know, past history of certain civilizations, like the Sumerians, the Mayans, the, you know, people on Easter Island. And so, for example, the people on Easter Island, they began to, you know, cut down the forest there. And, you know, we really don't know why they continued. Maybe they didn't realize what was going on, but there was population growth. They needed the wood from the trees in order to build their boats to go out and fish. But they ended up, you know, basically cutting down all the trees on Easter Island. And that ultimately led to their civilizational collapse. I mean, when they ran out of trees, and the soil became unstable. They couldn't, mm-hmm. you know, really grow things much more. They had an environmental collapse.
How were our mineral? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I couldn't hear that.
That's all right. I thought you were stopping for a second, so I was asking a question, but go ahead.
Okay. And And so if we look at the past civilizations, we have a lot to learn. And we're at a point now where I think we can still do things about it. And so, for example, if we look at a lot of the countries that have this very high population growth, it's because they really have lack of access to opportunity. The women in the population are highly uneducated. We need to educate women in these countries, and basically what that does is it allows women to be able to have a career, to be a productive member of society, as opposed to having children to kind of hedge their bets against the possibility of the majority of their children dying before they can get out and actually work the field, because a lot of these cultures are still agrarian-based economy.
I have to ask this question.
Sure.
Don't they understand what makes those children? When you talk to these leaders, don't they understand that?
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
I know it. I'm sorry. Don't the people in these underdeveloped countries understand where those children come from?
I think they absolutely do, but it's just part of their culture and part of what's always been done there. And if we look at the mortality rates in these countries, some of them are very, very high. And so I think if you understand, if you're a woman and you understand that, hey, there's a good probability that if I have 7 children, 3 or 4 of those are going to die.
Okay.
Even become teenagers, that it kind of perpetuates that idea that, hey, we need a lot of kids here if we're going to have enough hands in order to feed our family.
Okay.
And to put this into perspective, there's almost 3 billion people in the world that live on less than $2 a day. And so in these agrarian-type, really subsistence-living societies, it's critical to have all the hands that you can
to your
household.
And then a question: what are our mineral tables and salt tables and our water table? How does all of it stand now?
So it's interesting with water that you bring that up, because one of the things that Lester is now playing around with, and the idea is that we're at what is called peak water, or approaching it. And this is kind of a play off of peak oil. And for people who don't know what peak oil is, the world oil production right now is about 85 million barrels per day. And if we look at the 20 largest oil fields in the world, all of them were discovered and started production 30 or more years ago. And so as we continue to pump the oil out of the ground, we've suddenly, come up on a point now where we're at peak oil. And so what that means is that we can no longer pump any more oil than we're pumping today, because there's just not any left in the ground. And the technology just isn't here to improve the pumping rate. And so that in itself is an interesting study, because that's something that's totally new in the world. And so what peak oil means is that, as our oil demand increases, it's not that we can produce more. It means that we're going to have to get that oil from a country that's currently using it. And so for any one country to get more means another country has to get less. And that's something that I think a lot of countries have not really thought about yet. We're so heavily based on oil and oil for agriculture, too, that, how are we going to ensure our food security? But suddenly we're in a situation where we're almost out of oil. And this is something the U.S. really needs to think about, because the U.S. consumes about a quarter of the world's oil, and an alarming stat is that in our transportation system, the United States consumes more gasoline than the next top 20 countries combined. That's just almost mind-blowing to think about.
I have a question here I need to ask you. We got 10 minutes left, and I'm sure you guys keep up with what's going on politically, right?
Yeah.
I would imagine. Did we make the right choice in our leadership so that this things are going to happen to save us before it's too late? Or
I think that we absolutely did. I'm a big fan of Obama, and I think that so far he's made a lot of the right decisions, and I think that the leadership that he's picking, as far as the leaders that will head I think that with their leadership and what we're seeing is that they're really going to push this like new energy revolution, and that's going to be one of the primary components of really being able to get out of the cycle that we're in. I think that the most important thing that we have to address right now, or maybe the two most important things, one's population change, but we have to address global climate change. We have to address it now. And I think that under the Bush administration, and they're kind of dragging their feet on it and kind of the denial of climate change and not endorsing the Kyoto Protocol, that there was a real lost opportunity there. Not that I think that an international agreement will, be the end all to global climate change, but I think that the United States has to be a leader for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the United States is not leading the rest of the world, then we're going to have a very, very difficult time. But I'm very optimistic that under the Obama administration and some of the events that have been occurring in the last 2 months, that we're definitely on the right track, that with the economic stimulus plans and the money that we've seen allocated from that to renewable energy, to building a new, grid system in the United States, to really trying to bring us out of this economic slump by, creating jobs. And it's known that we have publications where we've developed models at Earth Policy Institute that show that, you create a lot more jobs in a green economy than you do in staying with the status quo and developing carbon-based energy sources. And so if you have the choice to build a wind farm or a coal-fired power plant, it makes much more sense to build the wind farm for mm-hmm. a number of reasons. One is that, the fuel for a wind farm is free. We're not having to, dig it out of the ground or import it from another country. And you create a lot more jobs from the wind farm.
Do you think that what's happened with the auto industry, let me see if I can word this right, will be that they'll take the opportunity of this crashing of the industry to start putting out a new kind of car, and that this kind of dead ends the fossil-using cars, and this will be the dawning of the new cars to not emit carbon-based material?
I think that it will be, and because the real crash in the auto industry, it stems from consumers realizing that, hey, we're at the situation of peak oil. We're seeing, gasoline prices skyrocketing because of the economic slump. Now, it's come back down. This is going to be a short-term blip on the radar. I mean, as the economy starts recovering, we're going to see gas prices escalate again. And so we're seeing consumers saying to the auto industry, you guys didn't think ahead at all. You're again being a reactive industry and not proactive. You're not thinking long term. And I think that, around the world, when we're looking at different car companies, I think not only are consumers, the governments are kind of fed up that they didn't innovate when they should. And I think that with GM, what we're going to see with, and I hope that the GM makes it simply because I think that they're one of the leaders in developing plug-in hybrid vehicles, and this would be the Chevy Volt. And so what this vehicle is, it's basically a vehicle that it runs on batteries, and it also has a backup gasoline engine for, long trips.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to go on long trips, of course, driving is relatively short. But you can plug this car right into the outlet of your house and charge it up with electricity.
What's that going to do? I mean, will we be able to afford to do that, Jonathan? My power bill, and I don't turn my air conditioning above 78 in the summer, and my power bill is like $500. Can we afford to run those kind of cars? Average person.
The average person would have it. If you actually look at the economics, much cheaper than driving on gasoline. The energy equivalent and what you're paying economically, it's only about 60 cents to drive the same distance as it is on a gallon of gasoline. So you're talking like 60 cents versus, at the height of the summer here, we're paying over $4 a gallon for gasoline.
One more question that I have, you got like 3 minutes if you can do it. And take a minute again to revisit where you are, where people can find you. Does your institute support feeding the world with genetically modified foods?
That has been a debate that I actually had with Lester, and I can't say that we stand firmly, on one side or the other. I in my personal opinion, feel that it's not a good idea.
And what does Lester think?
What does Lester think?
Yeah.
He's never really, it's interesting because I've never gotten him to say, like, whether he's truly supportive of it or not. I know he stands on the side that says genetic engineering isn't going to get us anywhere.
It's making people sick.
Yeah.
A lot of people.
Right. It tends to make a lot of people sick, and we don't know what happens when it gets in the environment. So just real quickly, my background actually is molecular biology.
Okay.
So I understand the danger of, you know, engineering and having these genes out in the environment because, you know, there are certain, you know, vectors in the environment that can go in there and zip these genes out, and they can actually be spread throughout different plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be very, very difficult, you know, to keep it contained, and we have a danger of kind of homogenizing the genetic stock of the world by, you know, promoting these genetically modified organisms. So I'm personally against
all of it scares me. Okay, take a couple minutes and tell people where to find you.
Okay, and so again, I'm from the Earth Policy Institute. On the web, we're at www.earthpolicy.org. And we can be reached by telephone at 202-496-9290. And I just want to remind everyone that all of our publications and everything that we think about is online. We usually have a release every 1 to 2 weeks about you know, current topics that we're thinking about. And all of our books and all the data behind our books is also available free online. And if you want a hard copy, a paper copy, which remember, you're, you know, making a tree if you do that, but we still have those available through us if you prefer that as opposed to reading it online.
Jonathan, thank you for a tremendously educational interview.
You
have a wealth of knowledge, and I'm just profoundly impressed. I thank you for taking your time to come on my show.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll come back.
Oh, definitely.
Good night, dear.
Night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. Integral Health. Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.